There are probably all sorts of connections with what Anne Marie was talking about this morning, but I was kind of here in body, but not so much in mind. A particular refrain though that really stuck with me was over the part towards the penultimate, in the penultimate section, where you kept going about you're healthily tired, take a rest. Must give paper. Anyway. I only did 25. So Pia, people can share that with me. Right, well, I'll get cracking. A huge amount of time. I won't go into what does Wittgenstein actually say in his early work on ethics, because I think you being who you are, I'll just point out three kind of just general sort of principles that I put in at the centre of what I'm trying to do. One of them is resolution. I think what I'm doing broadly is consistent with those requirements. Another one is the belief that the Wittgenstein is quite serious when he says that philosophy is full of fundamental confusions which arise through sign symbol conflation, situations where we're thinking either where we're sort of unwittingly flipping between thinking of thinking of a sentence as opposed to a proposition, or thinking of a name as either a mere dead sign, if you like, and thinking of it in connection with an already established use. So I think that's another of the sort of basic principles I want to try and accommodate. The third one is, which I think is the main thing I want to sort of put forward, is to emphasise a certain sort of personal spiritual stroke moral concern that Wittgenstein seems to have with the idea with the idea of decency. And the fourth principle, well, sort of an aim, an extra principle, if you like, is to try and make sense of the idea that the claim ethics is inexpressible could be something that could be a rung in a ladder that you climb and then throw away. So, that's just one of the claims I want to make, put sort of at the centre of what I'm trying to do. Incidentally, I do think we can take seriously that idea about sign symbol conflations being, if you like, the way in which philosophical confusions arise, but I'll only really talk about that in connection with the ethical here. I should also probably say that this is necessarily a little bit speculative because, we just don't have that much to go on when it comes to understanding what Wittgenstein means when he talks about ethics in the early work. But I think, if you're not willing to speculate a little bit, then that means you just have to not discuss the topic. So, in I go. Now, there is a particular concern, I think, that we can see in Wittgenstein's own life, and something that I think that his biographers agree on, that there's a concern with something you could call decency, and I'm going to connect it to other concepts like conscience, in particular, but also goodwill. But here are the biographers. Here's Monk. He said, Wittgenstein's life might be said to have been dominated by an ethical struggle, the struggle to be anständig, or decent, which for him meant, above all, overcoming the temptation presented by his pride and vanity to be dishonest. Similarly, McGinnis claims that Wittgenstein sought to engage his friends and disciples in a moral enterprise characterised, above all, by the effort to see clearly and to be completely honest with oneself and others. And I'll argue that Wittgenstein's concern with this struggle naturally expresses itself as a concern with, on a construal that we've got independent grounds to believe Wittgenstein embraced, philosophy itself. So Wittgenstein's ethical concern is a kind of meta-philosophical concern at the same time. Just to look at a couple of the items that might sort of make this connection with decency seem plausible, here's a letter that I don't think gets discussed very often to Engelmann. It's true there's a difference between myself now and as I was when we met in Almonds. And as far as I know, the difference is that I'm now slightly more decent. By this, I only mean that I'm slightly clearer in my own mind about my lack of decency. If you tell me now that I have no faith, you're perfectly right, only I did not have it before either. It's plain, isn't it, that when a man wants, as it were, to invent a machine for becoming decent, such a man has no faith. But what am I to do? I'm clear about one thing. I'm far too bad to be able to theorise about myself. In fact, I shall either remain a swine or else I shall improve, and that's that. Only let's cut out the transcendental twaddle or geschwätz when the whole thing is as plain as a sock on the jaw. So, Wittgenstein being casual and a bit pugilistic. You like that. So, one thing I won't comment on here is what does Wittgenstein mean by faith here? I think it actually connects up with some of the kinds of things that Anne-Marie was talking about this morning, because you got these lines in the notebooks where he talks about... I mean, the obvious thought is, does he mean literally belief in God? I don't think he does mean something. I think he means something more like the sense that life has a meaning. But I won't talk about that for now. So another little bit of evidence for this, for this concern, if you like. In a remark to Schlick, Wittgenstein states bluntly, running up against the limits of language is ethics. He immediately goes on to call for an end to all the claptrap, geschwätz, again, about ethics, whether intuitive knowledge exists, whether values exist, whether the good is definable. And then in a 1931 remark, which is in Culture and Value, Wittgenstein's commenting on the great temptation to want to make the spirit explicit. It's a phrase he uses immediately after the one I'm going to quote. He says that when you bump against the limits of your own decency, and ständig case, it's as though a whirlpool of thoughts is generated and an endless regress. You may say what you like, it gets you no further. So, you know, what I'm suggesting is there might be something in the notion of a running up against the limits of language, which has something to do with the idea of decency, that in some way decency represents a limit of some sort. What I want to suggest is that Wittgenstein's concern with philosophy's geschwätz, with its claptrap, its twaddle, is simultaneously concerned with anständigkeit. Now, I should mention, in the course of this paper, we sort of come at the idea of decency, come at the idea of conscience, three or four times, and each time we'll sort of see it's a slightly different kind of problem. I think we're sort of working towards an understanding of that really this concern with decency or conscience is really a metaphilosophical one. So I'll present conscience a couple of times, but it's only, if you like, on the final pass that we get to what I think is, if you like, the correct view, the enlightened view. Now, surely our best hope of understanding what Wittgenstein means by ethics is to connect it with the kinds of remarks he makes about logic, because he famously connects the two. He says things like ethics does not treat the world, ethics must be a condition of the world like logic. And just as the logic of our propositions cannot be represented, ethics can't be expressed. Instead, they're both transcendental and will become clear, in a sense, are unteachable in conversation with the Schlick. Wittgenstein talks about, says that what is ethical cannot be taught. Now, I'll just sort of present an initial parallel between, if you like, the case of something like an ethical fact and a logical fact. This is, I'm passing over all sorts of complexities, but that's life. And I want to sort of do it in a way which starts off by thinking about the idea of what is involved in learning a first language. When you learn a second language, you could say that what you're doing is you're learning a certain fact about a sign. You're learning that in a particular language, this sign is used to express the same thing as this sign expresses in your own, say, first language. But what is it like to learn a first language? What's it like to initially acquire that, if you like, that reference point using which you go on to learn a second language? It can't be a matter of... It can't be the same kind of process, because, obviously, the process I described as the language, second language presupposes that you've already got a first language. And there are remarks in the Tractatus which seem to sort of shockingly suggest that, that it may not really be possible to learn a first language. So you've got remarks, this isn't on the handout, this is 4026. The meanings of the simple signs of the words must be explained to us if we are to understand them. However, it is by means of propositions that we explain ourselves. So you have this funny situation where you're being told, how are you going to learn the meaning of these words? Well, they'll be explained to you through propositions, and then you wonder, well, how am I going to understand these propositions? Because I have to understand the words. Now, I think there's a certain plausible thought behind that seemingly nutty thought. And we can think about it, this is, again, moving very fast, we can think about it in connection with something like ostensive definition. This is obviously to sort of look a little bit into the future, towards the later work. Certainly, if we imagine learning a sign through something like an ostensive definition, learning an item from a second language, then what we're imagining is we learn that this word, X, is used to refer to what my first language calls, say, red. But if we are imagining that an ostensive definition might teach someone instead a first language expression, let's just for the sake of argument say, I'd call it a symbol, then we run into trouble. Because in order to see what is being pointed at through an ostensive definition, then the pupil must already have a mastery of the relevant symbol, which is precisely what the explanation was to make possible. So, you know, you have to already break up the world in appropriate ways in order to see what it is that the person is pointing at. So, if you don't already have the concept of colour, if somebody points at something and says brown, then if you're not already breaking up the world in the way in which the concept colour does, then you, if you like, won't be able to see what the person's pointing at. So I think that's, if you like, that's part of the sensible thought behind the idea that according to a certain notion of what it is to teach, a first language might not be teachable. Now, I think there's an initial parallel can be seen with the ethical case if we look at a remark from 1931, which is on the handout, where he says, nothing we do can be defended absolutely and finally, but only by reference to something else that is not questioned, i.e. no reason can be given why you should act or should have acted like this, except that by doing so, you bring about such and such a situation, which again has to be an aim you accept. Now, in a way, you could feel here that what we're running up against is a certain sort of limitation on the explanatory power of reasons. Inasmuch as reasons, you know, in both cases, I suggest, inasmuch as reasons cannot bring it about that one ultimately accepts this final aim that says referring to, it seems impossible to teach someone how they should act. Such reasons seem confined to explaining what Wittgenstein calls matters of relative value. Correspondingly, efforts to tell someone how a proposition represents, or what a word means, must be made by means of a proposition. It's by means of propositions that we explain ourselves. So such explanations can only move one on, so to speak, to a proposition one already understands, just as justifications of actions can only move one on to an aim one already accepts. So I think we can sort of see that there's an initial story to be told about a certain kind of limitation on the kinds of explanations you can offer when it comes to explaining something like a first language and when it comes to teaching someone ethics. And this kind of negative insight, a certain kind of regress point, which I think is kind of similar to one that Michael Kramer's talked about, has got to be part of the story, but I want to press on a bit further because in particular, I think so far we haven't seen any connection with what we might call decency, which I want to suggest is important. What place does a seeming obsession with honesty with oneself have here? So what I want to do is sort of back off again and think about another reason why one might say that ethics lies beyond the sayable, that ethics is in a way inexpressible. And I'll do through an example which I like. It's from Three Men and a Boat by Joe Higgero. Some of this stuff overlaps with a paper that I gave in Berg, so apologies to the Bergites. I lived with a man once who would loll on the sofa and watch me doing things by the hour together, following me around the room with his eyes wherever I went. He said it did him real good to look on at me messing about. He said it made him feel that life was not an idle dream to be gaped at and yawned through, but a noble task full of duty and stern work. He said he often wondered how he could have gone on before he met me, never having anybody to look at while they worked. Now, what does such a character lack? A concept we naturally reach for here is conscience. A concept that Wittgenstein discusses, if obscurely, in the notebooks and uses in his personal diaries of the period as well. In both cases, you know, in both contexts, conscience plays the role of some kind of intimation that we're acting rightly or wrongly, an intimation that Wittgenstein doesn't look to principle to provide. So, just to look at this, well, just to read to present you with this difficult passage. When my conscience upsets my equilibrium, then I'm not in agreement with something, but what is this? Is it the world? Certainly it's correct to say conscience is the voice of God. For example, it makes me unhappy to think that I've offended such and such a man. Is that my conscience? Can one say, act according to your conscience, whatever it may be? So, you know, that passage I just kind of offers, showing the conscience is, if you like, one of his concepts. So what is conscience? Well, conscience is discussed most thoroughly philosophically in the medieval period, where in a bunch of different ways, synderesis, which is understood as insight into the general and fundamental principles of right action, is seen as requiring augmentation by conscientia, understood as the faculty of applying ethical principles in deliberation. One might describe conscientia as the means by which our knowledge of right and wrong is applied, the glue between what we believe is right and our treating it as right. Now, one of the reasons why I'm interested in conscience is because it looks to me like there's already a concept within the moral philosophical tradition which articulates the idea that at a certain point in our ethical deliberation we run up against something you might say is inexpressible, and that concept is conscience. The dominant metaphor used in the Christian tradition to articulate the idea of conscience is that of an inner voice. It's an inner voice because it must be a natural gift, in that the only person who could benefit from guidance in the application of a principle is someone who's already of good conscience, someone who can already apply the guidance appropriately. Hence the reason why conscience is only metaphorically a voice is because, if you like, a fantasized voice, inner or outer, that did say something would still leave us facing the problem of conscience, how to apply what that impossible conscience said to us. So in a way you can sort of see that when you run into the problem of conscience, anything that someone might say to you is not going to help you out, because if you have bad conscience, you'll take whatever they say and apply it in an ill-willed way, misapply it, twist it. That's the notion. So in a certain sense you could say when you run into conscience you run up against a certain kind of limit on the sale. Now, just to go back to the connection with logic, we could extend the analogy here by seeing the problem of teaching a first language as itself, in a way, you know, you could look at it as something like a similar problem of application, and to throw up the need for an analogous power. Setting aside various complications, when you're learning a second language sign, the pupil comes to understand what a particular term denotes, that it denotes a particular kind of thing. But our mastery of language can't be a matter of mastery of such rules all the way down, if you like. We seem to run into the need for a capacity which, following Kant, we might call judgment. And this is the faculty of subsuming under rules, which Kant calls a peculiar talent which can be practiced only and cannot be taught. Like the inner voice of conscience, this talent must belong to the learner himself, must be a natural gift, as Kant puts it. So if you like, we've got a sort of prima facie, you know, sketch of a case for thinking that reflection on logic and reflection on ethics will ultimately lead us up against a certain kind of inexpressible knowledge. You know, is this kind of story the reason why logic ultimately can't be represented? And is this why ethics, what makes a person, a good person good and a bad person bad, what is this why it's inexpressible? Now, given the kind of general resolute approach that I want to take, You know, what do resolute people think of inevitable knowledge? They don't like it. So what I want to suggest is there's another way to go. What we've got to do is re-examine the philosophical pursuit of reasons that leads us to sort of run up against this, run up against conscience, run up against judgment, understood in the way that I've set out. And suggest that, if you like, the important point here is not so much that the philosophical pursuit of reasons is always going to be frustrated, as the need for ineffable knowledge, that is conscience or judgment, might seem to show, but instead that the philosophical pursuit of reasons here, in some way there's a confusion going on. And to see this is to undo our sense that there's, you know, something that we cannot do, that theme from the investigations that Corey Diamond's in particular has emphasized in Chip 2. My suggestion is that even if per impossibile, we could uncover foundational reasons, we wouldn't want them. In other words, and crucially, we don't really understand what it is that we want. And moreover, we can see this when we recognize that the pursuit, that confused pursuit is recognized to be an unethical pursuit. And this is going to take us in towards another Kantian connection. Conscience, I think, belongs to a family of concepts of which goodwill is a member, decency is another. I'm going to add maturity in a moment. The person without conscience may say, perhaps even to himself, that he holds a particular view, but he doesn't really. He may say, perhaps even to himself, that he's committed to a particular principle, but he'll apply it or interpret it in an ill-willed way. Such a person can say all he likes and can be told all one likes. What he lacks is a certain basic decency. Conscience is a concept, I want to suggest, that points, if you like, in two directions. It points towards the world as a capacity to apply our beliefs to the world. That's one construal of what conscience is. And the other direction it points in, if you like, is towards the self, as a matter of being true to oneself. To have a conscience that fails us is to not truly believe what we think and might, for example, say we believe. In such a condition, we fail to maintain in our lives the form of order that's required of others, or indeed we ourselves, are to take our utterances seriously, as genuinely expressing things we believe, as opposed to mere, to use a Heideggerian expression, idle talk. To take our actions seriously, as informed by genuinely held commitments, as opposed to mere token gestures. So if you like, between what these thoughts about conscience seem to point us to, is that between ethical principle, or doctrine, and the ethical life, there's a certain kind of gulf that's populated by rationalization, hypocrisy, self-deception. And believing that a body of such doctrine might capture the character of such a life is an attempt to deny that that gulf and its denizens exist. That's what I'm sort of suggesting in a way. There's something fishy about this kind of pursuit of reasons here. From this perspective, this pursuit of ethical doctrine, understood as the demand for finally and foundationally principled action, appears not only merely philosophically confused, it also has an ethical or perhaps spiritual meaning. It's to succumb to a certain kind of immorality, a certain kind of in or sub-humanity, to believe in values coming to us like facts rather than being an admirable demand for a comprehensive accountability, is a refusal, I'm going to suggest, to be a moral agent, someone who takes responsibility for their actions. It's a desire to be told what to do, to have responsibility for what happens taken on by someone or something else. Now, there's a long tradition of in philosophy of worries about the idea of ethical fact. So you've got Hume on his ought, Moore on naturalistic fallacy, John Mackey on the argument from queerness, for instance. But I think more fundamental is the ethical or spiritual worry that Kant captures in his conception of immaturity. He says laziness, and this is from the essay on what is enlightenment, laziness and cowardice are the reasons why such a large proportion of men, even when nature has long emancipated them from alien guidance, nevertheless gladly remain immature for life. It's so convenient to be immature. If I have a book to have my understanding in place of me, a spiritual advisor to have a conscience for me, a doctor to judge my diet for me, and so on, I need not make any efforts at all. I need not think so long as I'm okay. Others will soon enough take the tiresome job over for me. Now, I think we can sort of see here already that, you know, we sort of feel, you know, we sort of think about the pursuit of reasons and, you know, explaining and justifying our actions as something which, unfortunately, the last hurdle is to be disappointed. You know, you run into something like conscience. But I think this kind of Kantian thought suggests we don't really know what we're after here, because in a sense, if we got what we were after, we wouldn't want it. If our maturity is a matter of renouncing the notion of an ethical expert who would tell us how we should act, then we must also renounce the notion of an ethical fact which would make nature or God or whatever that ethical expert. What I'm suggesting is that the confused notion of ethical fact hides an uncomfortable truth about responsibility. The ethical expert can tell me to take certain facts seriously and act on those, but I must still decide whether to take that ethical expert seriously. And the same will be true of any ethical principle that one might cite, to revisit the line that Anne-Marie quoted: when a general ethical law of the form thou shalt is set up, the first thought is, suppose I do not do it. Does the fact that this question can always be asked show that ethical judgments are groundless? Well, an alternative interpretation of this predicament is that responsibility for my actions ultimately lies with me. One way of characterising what makes something my decision, one for which I am responsible, is that it exists in a space where I know there might well be room for argument, where I know that my reasons might be questioned. Now, that's not to act without reasons, rather it's a willingness to adopt reasons as my own, to let a rule have weight with me by guiding my actions without having yet another explanation to hand of why I interpreted the reason in the way that I did. Now, from this perspective, the moral philosopher's pursuit of ethical doctrine appears to be a certain repeated deferral of responsibility, a refusal to be willing to be the person who will be held to account for what's done, to be the person whose reasons critics of the action will scrutinise. Such a refusal is a refusal to take decisions, an insistence that one will only decide when the decision is taken out of one's hands by the force of the better argument. And we find here a certain kind of, the distinction between justification and rationalisation, where defending my decision merges with showing that it wasn't my decision and a consequence of relevant rules, where showing I was not irresponsible merges with a refusal to take on responsibility. So what we have here is a certain model of rational action. It's a kind of demand for explanation, serves perhaps a will to deny that one must eventually speak for oneself. One must take responsibility on oneself rather than acting on orders, acting at the will of a higher authority. So beyond, if you like, the logical limitation that judgment and conscience, understood as capacities to apply doctrine, seem to represent, is, if you like, the ethical point that the search for an ethical doctrine, the animistic, if you like, craving that the meaning of life might come to me as a fact to be discovered, expresses a certain kind of dream of anonymity, if you like, freedom from responsibility. And through, if you like, this evasion of the challenge of assuming responsibility, of acting with conscience, what the philosopher seems to be seeking is, one might say, a machine for becoming decent. Now, something I'll pass over is the way in which I think the idea of logical truth kind of conspires in something like that kind of evasion. Very roughly, if you like, what we look to the idea of logical fact to do is something which will dictate to us that the kinds of terms which we use in the course of our lives to describe the kinds of things that we find around us is, if you like, dictated by the things themselves. So we discuss a particular person's life situation in terms of concepts which are in some way, if you like, natural to the object that we're talking about. And I think a certain kind of responsibility is allowed, it is obscured in that way. We're sort of fantasizing that there's a certain sort of reason there why we talk in the ways that we do, which isn't really there. Ultimately, it's if you like a projection of the ways in which we happen to talk onto the world in such a way that we think we see there are reasons why we must talk in the way that we do. So, but obviously, I could go into that if I'm still awake. Now, if what I've said so far is right, then there's something fishy about the problem of application. There's something fishy about the way in which the conscience and judgment emerge the first time round. Because I've suggested that in a way, if we could complete that mission, if we didn't run into conscience, we actually wouldn't want what we find at the end of that road anyway. Now, my suggestion is that the emergence of conscience can be seen, a certain kind of inexpressible knowledge, if you like, can be seen as a step on the way to recognizing the philosopher's confused aspiration, on the philosopher's part, a way in which, if you like, the emergence of conscience, the emergence of this kind of inexpressible knowledge is a way in which this confusion can show itself. That the need for an inexpressible power arises when we cannot understand the exercise of a particular capacity as resting on the grasping of a reason, a doctrine, something that might be said. What that ought ultimately to direct our attention to is, if you like, back to our understanding of and ambitions for such a reason, for such a doctrine. So instead of, when we run into the inexpressible, what that should make us do is turn around and look at what we think the expressible is meant to be. Running into the need for conscientia ought ultimately to make us re-examine what we take synderesis to be, if you like. And of course, when we do that, we're also going to reassess what we take conscientia to be too. And it's here that we can come to see conscience as something like a rung of a ladder to be climbed up and then thrown away. Because once we've reassessed what we think synderesis is, what the expressible is, then we'll reassess what we thought we ran into when we ran into what we thought was this inexpressible knowledge. So we're going to try and suggest that, if you like, the problem of application in which judgment and conscience were sort of nestled, there's something confused about it. In certain contexts, using concepts including those of lying, self-deception, weakness of the will, then we can talk of believing something but not acting in line with that belief, of failing to apply what we believe. But can we sensibly distinguish in a quite general way between a principle or belief and its application? I would suggest we can't. It's easy to think we can imagine the kinds of particular misapplication mentioned, worsening, and that these imagined situations would sensibly be described as cases of greater and greater breakdown in our capacity to apply our beliefs. But though one certainly may say that someone says something is wrong though he still does it, one also sometimes comes to say he can't really mean it when he says this act is wrong or he wouldn't do it. It comes a point in which one will ask why we still ascribe those particular beliefs to the person, and a further point at which we will ask why we ascribe beliefs to the same person at all. What I would suggest is a certain construal of our talk of synderesis and conscientia suggests the possibility that a breakdown in conscientia might leave us stranded with our synderesis, or knowledge of principles, unable to bring those principles to bear on the world. But that's misleading, because a certain minimal conscientia is necessary before we can even ascribe synderesis in the first place. In order to think of someone as guided by principle, we need to see their act as, so to speak, successfully guided by principle. Their lives must manifest a certain degree of appropriate order. We must imagine presence of such an order if we're to imagine someone following a rule, since we imagine that rule having some sort of anchor in that person's thinking and behaviour. And that's required if we're to imagine them trying to follow that particular rule rather than others, or none at all. But if so, there can't be a quite general problem of application that conscientia solves. No general issue of how synderesis can go on to find application. Because it makes no sense to ascribe synderesis to someone without conscientia. In attempting to formulate the problem, we want to imagine, say, two people who hold the same principle, have the same synderesis, but differ in that one can apply it correctly while the other can't. But actually, we're only entitled to say that these people, in the face of the question, what do you believe, produce the same string of marks on paper or sound waves in the air. Such entities don't embody any kind of semantic demand that one might imagine competent capacities to apply respect. And thus, there's no problem of application for these so-called principles. Such entities can be applied however one wants. Given how the two people use these strings of signs, mere signs, the place they have, the difference they make in their lives, then you might well ask, why do we continue to think of those principles as expressing the same symbol? To echo that line from Tractatus. So what I'm suggesting is that the root problem here, the way in which we run into the inexpressible in the way that I've described, the root problem here is our understanding of the sayable. And we run into it by succumbing to a certain kind of sign-symbol conflation. My suggestion is that we need to equivocate over what we take the principles in question to be. We must simultaneously and confusedly think of these principles as signs, as dead sentences, and as symbols, as signs in use, as meaningful. As the former, they're contingently connected to their use in any particular language, but as the latter, they're internally related to their use. One has not identified something as a symbol if one doesn't know how it's used. And the confused fantasy of application and misapplication arises when we hear the former contingency and the latter necessity, but fail to see that they concern two different things. It, the sign, can be used in all sorts of ways that would not be in line with its, the sign in use, the symbol, its meaning. What power the problem forces us to ask allows us to keep them in line, but the problem is confused. So what I'm suggesting is that our problem that reveals the inexpressible and unteachable powers of judgment and conscience arise when we fail to make sense of aspirations that we have for an illusion, a mirage upon which we've drawn in assigning what we now see are confused senses to expressible, and I would go on to talk about this teachable, but I don't have time. Our notion of what is expressible is that which is capturable within the, so to speak, enchanted sentences that our sign symbol confusion conjures up. The supplement that they need are what we think of as, in contrast, unteachable and inexpressible. Our sense that there must be an inexpressible power of judgment or conscience arises when we cannot understand our capacity to use language as embodied in the grasping of reasons, but the reasons in question are confused, they're sign symbol equivocations. Our sense that our use of language must be guided by a grasp of such reasons, and our sense that it can't be so guided, and thus must rest on an inexpressible capacity to go beyond such guidance, both of those rest on the same confused notion of what guidance is, the coming into possession of what are in fact mirages. Now I think what this means then is that since the capacities of judgment and conscience are themselves articulated in one of our earlier formulations, in terms of the notions upon which their discovery should cast doubt, then one of the things that's going to happen is we're going to throw away a certain understanding of what judgment and conscience is. Our fantasy about expression and about the inexpressible are two sides of the same coin. In that encountering something that resists capture in such an expression, a reason, a saying, is taken to be an encounter with something that cannot be expressed, are finding ourselves forced to postulate these inexpressible and unteachable capacities does not, I'm suggesting, reveal the limits of the expressible or the teachable, the limits of reason or the sayable, but instead throw into relief hitherto unrecognized confusion, confused aspirations on behalf of, confused fantasies for and of, expression, teaching, reason, saying, and so on. And in doing so, it should also force us to reconsider what that discovery is. The uncovering of judgment and conscience are rungs on a ladder that's to be thrown away. I'll just end with looking at a passage which I think is kind of interesting from Engelmann published a memoir with the letters that he received from Wittgenstein. And in the last chapter, which is called Wordless Faith, I think you can sort of see a certain kind of pushing and pulling around the notion of ethics being inexpressible. I've suggested in a way when we run into the inexpressible, what we need to see is not, if you like, a limit to the sayable, but we need to see that a certain notion of what is sayable, certain confusion about the takes the sayable as its vehicle, and we need to recognise that. So if you like, we don't realise that we run into this inexpressible power, we realise that we're in the grip of a certain confusion. Then confusion is, a sign symbol conflation. Overall, what I want to suggest is that Wittgenstein doesn't deny us any particular concept. He doesn't have it in for, the sayable in connection with ethics. What he's concerned about is a certain kind of misunderstanding of all the different kinds of concepts that we do use. Once we've recognised the confusions, then you can quite happily go back to talk about saying, expression in the ethical domain. What I think Wittgenstein's saying to us is that you can have the full range of concepts that we actually do use in talking about morality and responsibility concepts like principle, conscience, justification, integrity, all those concepts. Now, And just to make clearer why I think this is a metaphilosophical insight, you might want to call this an insight. But in a way, you might say it's an insight for someone descending from the philosophical heights. But once embraced, it takes on the air of a kind of truism. Crucially, you might ask, who would ever have thought differently? We're going to be left with like homespun demands such as go ahead and seek principles that help articulate what we think is right and wrong, but do so soberly, without believing that they might one day spare us the trouble of thinking. But then who ever did think that one might entomb responsibility in a sentence, in a string of marks on paper, which is why I'm suggesting it's ultimately something like the model that's shaping our thinking here. And what I want to say is that the only people who ever did think that were philosophers, and even they had to be confused to thinking. So we kind of conjured up an issue here. Now what you see in the Engelmann passage is a certain sort of uncomfortableness about... do you want to say that ethics is inexpressible? I think you can see Engelmann is sort of influenced by Wittgenstein. I'll just present the piece. Engelmann says that what Wittgenstein's life and work shows is the possibility of a new spiritual attitude, which, if adopted, I've got some of the typing wrong on the handout, I'm afraid, but which, if adopted by other individuals of the right stature, will be the source from which new forms of society will spring, forms that need no verbal communication because they will be lived and thus made manifest. She talks about ideals that will not be communicated by attempts to describe them, but by models of an appropriate conduct of life. But I think there's another kind of force within the Engelmann piece. His reason, if you like, for turning on the idea of assayable doctrine. Well, it goes on, such exemplary lives will be of incomparable value educationally. No doctrine conveyed in words can be a substitute for it. For even if such communication should succeed to the extent of enabling those who have already grasped its point through personal experience to apply it and realise it in their own lives, fact remains that any doctrine uttered in words is the source of its own misconstruction by worshippers, disciples and supporters. It's they who have so far, without exception, robbed all doctrines laid down in words of their effect, and who always threaten to turn the blessing into a curse. Now, it looks to me that this passage embodies a bad argument for believing that we need to embrace a wordless faith, as it puts it. That a doctrine uttered in words can be misconstrued does not show that it cannot be passed on through successful people. Such words may not provide an infallible guarantee that those who hear them will grasp the doctrine, but it seems to me that only someone who believed in enchanted words would expect that. And Engelmann recognises this in other parts of the passage. Ideals themselves, insofar as they are meant seriously as something to be translated into reality, cannot be communicated in words. They are of the spirit and can be indestructibly demonstrated only by making them real. What still needs to be said after that by way of showing, explaining, teaching can be done in relatively few words. Only in this way can the word be restored to the value, the weight that belongs to it by right. So suddenly the word is back, looking good. Engelmann insists that, he says, the necessary talking can and should be a realization of the spirit, not a cheap substitute. Fine. Not empty phrases, excellent, great. Verbiage, we want to avoid verbiage and cliches. But to condemn phrases in general for the sins of empty phrases seems unjust. The lesson that a recognition of such potential emptiness should teach us is that we must ensure that the phrases that we do use are full, that they're not empty. Not that we should abandon phrases altogether to some kind of wordless faith. Who, one might ask, would react in that latter kind of way? By reference to whose ambitions for phrases would a recognition of the possibility of their misconstruction and of their inability to convey to us how their message ought to be applied and realised in our lives indicate that we may as well be done with phrases altogether? Again, it seems to me it's those who believe in enchanted words, words that would somehow entomb within them the achievement of responsibility. It's those people whose ambition suffers, a certain confused philosophical ambition, that mere dead words might capture the good life. If so, the conclusion we should reach, and it's one that Engelmann himself is driven to in this tortured text, is that we're estranged from the devalued, not the living word. So what I'm suggesting is, if you like, it's only on the basis of a certain kind of fantasy of what the expressible, what the sayable will do for you, that you run into the inexpressible, that you understand the concept of conscience, the concept of decency as we use it, as conveying some sort of inexpressible, rationally impenetrable power. But we can see how we run into it when we pursue the philosophically confused pursuit of those kinds of reasons. But then when we run into it, what we need to do is not say, wow, there's this kind of inexpressible knowledge out there. We need to turn around and think about, well, so what are we taking the expressible to be? And in the way in which I try to sort of dismantle the problem of application, if you like, what I suggested there is that you need to be thinking of, if you like, enchanted words. You need to be thinking of certain sign symbol conflations as being what the sayable, the expressible, what principles are. And it's only relative to that that you run into, you then find yourself staring at these mysterious and inexpressible powers. Sorry, it's been a bit garbled.
We have about 10 minutes.